90.3 FM in Minneapolis and on the web at kfai.org.
You are listening to North Star Stories, Voices from Where We Live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
Today, travelers with disabilities are getting new resources at Minnesota's main airport. Then, a culinary gem hidden in northern Minnesota. And a new bridge opens along Minnesota's North Shore. I'm Chantel Saints. The Minneapolis-St. Paul International Airport, also known as MSP, is launching a new program to help travelers with hidden disabilities get the support they need. MSP has partnered with the European-based company Hidden Disabilities Sunflower Organization to offer sunflower-printed lanyards. The lanyards allow travelers to discreetly signal to airport staff that they may need additional assistance or patience. Anyone with a hidden disability can request a lanyard. In today's main story, there's a food desert of sorts in northern Minnesota, especially when it comes to authentic Asian cuisine. But as Frankie Falegi explains, there's a hidden gem, you just have to know where to look.
It smells really good.
Here's an unassuming spot for a delicious hot meal from across the globe, a convenience store. Not for pizza slices and hot dogs, but real Filipino food. Meet Nanay's Kitchen in Duluth. For nearly 10 years now, Beth Cañete has been dishing up authentic steam buns and noodles to swaths of regular customers.
I started with the basic stuff like, you know, like the egg rolls and then the empanadas and lumpia empanadas and then the chupao, the steam buns.
These are a rarity around here. Darby Dwyer, whose mom is Filipino, says there are very few places to get international food, let alone good international food, around Duluth. He's a regular customer.
I feel like we lost a lot of international cuisine that we had up here, but this is one of the spots where you can go and get some really good Filipino cuisine.
Beth's counter sits modestly inside the Gnesin convenience store. It's off a rural road, nestled between a small creek and swaths of trees. Minnesotans across the state regularly make the trek just for a plateful.
I have my customers today from International Falls. They drive all the way here just for this. I have customers like the people from Ely. They make it as their destination.
It's easy to see why. Beth's mouthwatering cast of authentic food isn't from a recipe book or an online blog. It comes from a secret ingredient.
Here, love, the love of cooking. That's the secret. That's the ingredients that nobody can take it away from me.
The nene in Nene's Kitchen means mom in Filipino. After all, Beth learned to cook by eating what her mother made and by feeding her own children. When she's not busy cooking in the back kitchen, it seems like she's thinking about everyone else's moms.
Hey, thank you. Say hi to your mom.
I will, thank you.
If you turn around after ordering your lunch, you'll see shelves of Filipino, Japanese, Korean, and Thai ingredients, something that customers like Darby Dwyer appreciate.
Pancit, the noodles are available up here, and some of the drinks, coconut water, mango, nectar, and it's honestly a hidden gem where you can find a lot of obscure items in the store that are from international markets.
For over 30 years, Beth and her husband, Grini, have run the store and kept its international shelves growing.
Okay, 83 and 29 for you, buds, please.
Starting up again in the spring, customers can find to-go orders on Fridays and Saturdays. In the winter, Cañete offers advance notice orders for larger parties.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Good to see you guys.
Anyone who wants to cook up their own authentic Asian cuisine this winter can purchase the ingredients in, of all places, a convenience store in northern Minnesota. For North Star Stories, I'm Frankie Falegi.
You are listening to North Star Stories. A major upgrade is now complete at one of Minnesota's most popular North Shore destinations. The Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, has reopened the High Falls Bridge at Teteguch State Park on Lake Superior after a full season of construction. The rebuild includes major improvements that the DNR says will help withstand future flooding. The new bridge is now open to visitors.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
In today's broadcast, license plate cameras are raising questions in West St. Paul, then a debate about a potential mine in a northern community, and a clearing in the road for driverless cars in another part of the state. I'm CJ. The West St. Paul Police Department has launched a pilot program using automated license plate cameras to help police track wanted vehicles. The devices capture license plates as cars drive by and check them against a state database. The city has installed 4 cameras, with 6 more on the way. While the police say the program is already showing results, some residents have raised concerns about surveillance and data privacy. The department says it hopes to maintain strict control over how the data is used. Next, residents are questioning the environmental impacts of a potential mine in northern Minnesota. Amper's member station KAXE and KBXE news director Chelsea Perkins talks with Victor Palomino about the controversy.
The community of Emily, Minnesota, located about 30 miles north of Brainerd, has spent nearly 2 decades hearing from companies interested in mining for manganese in the area.
In the 1940s and 50s, it was first discovered that this area had manganese deposits, and recent drilling has determined that the manganese is very rich and could have the potential to be one of the only sources of manganese in North America.
That's Amper's member station, KAXE, KBXE news director Chelsea Perkins. She explained that the CEO of the company, North Star Manganese, recently attended an Emily City Council meeting to present the findings of its latest studies.
He was there to say, hey, we had this study done. We have found out that this is economically viable, and basically we could make back our investment in less than 2 years with the potential of nearly a quarter of a century of manganese production from this mine.
Manganese is a key material for electric battery production and other technologies, and for a small community like Emily, the discovery could be significant.
There's been many years of various mining companies exploring this area, and there's been promises made in the past to the people of Emily.
This history has helped prepare residents to better understand what to look for when companies present these kinds of promises.
There's a lot of concern about manganese levels rising in water wells in the community. And manganese is something that can impact people's health in a negative way if it's in high amounts in the water.
But one of the main questions raised at the city council meeting is, what are the next steps?
There are many, many, many more steps that would need to happen before a mine would open, and likely it's years down the road still. They're at the pre-feasibility stage, essentially. Like, we need to do more research in order to even present whether this is truly feasible beyond just the economics of the situation.
Chelsea also mentioned that there needs to be more data collection, discussions with trade unions, and permits from the Department of Natural Resources before anything can move on. For now, the community is ready and organizing.
Emily City Council member Dan Brennan is part of a citizen group as well that's been looking into this for years. He spoke on behalf of some of these residents that were there sharing their concerns. The organization itself actually went forward with some baseline testing of water wells so that they can feel comfortable knowing we have this information about what our water is like now. So if they start to see rises in manganese in their water, they have something to point to as the baseline.
To listen to the full story and all the news from the north part of the state,
you can visit our website, kaxe.org, where you can also stream our station.
For North Star Stories, I'm Victor Palomino.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Well, don't be shocked if the car next to you in Minneapolis is heading down the road without a driver. Waymo, the self-driving vehicle company, has begun early testing in the city as it explores launching a driverless ride service. The vehicles are loaded with sensors, cameras, and software, allowing them to operate without a human driver behind the wheel. Waymo says Minneapolis was selected in part for its harsh winter weather. Go Marty already offers driverless transit in northern Minnesota.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
In today's stories, Minnesota lawmakers condemn the end of protections for refugees. Then, why thousands of Minnesotans are at risk of food insecurity. And some patients in the Twin Cities are getting a little extra help when it comes to practicing their religions. I'm Chantel Sings. The Minnesota Senate Asian Pacific Caucus is condemning the Trump administration's move to end temporary protected status, or TPS, for nearly 4,000 Minnesota immigrants from Southeast Asia. Most of those immigrants are members of the Karen community from the eastern region of Myanmar, formerly known as Burma. Minnesota is home to about 20,000 people from the Karen community, making it the largest in the country. This move follows the administration's announcement to end TPS protections for Somali Minnesotans. Next, nearly 500,000 Minnesotans are receiving food benefits, but even with the federal programs back in operation, thousands of Minnesotans could lose their benefits entirely. Producer Nak Bui explains why.
The shutdown was just the latest curveball for Minnesotans on SNAP. That's the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, a federal program that helps people pay for groceries.
I think it's a very difficult time for SNAP recipients right now, just to understand and keep up with the ever-changing nature of what has been happening.
Tiki Brown is the commissioner of the Department of Children, Youth, and Families, or DCYF, which oversees the implementation of the SNAP program in our state. Even though payments are back on schedule, Commissioner Brown says there are significant changes to SNAP ahead and already in place as a result of the One Big Beautiful Bill, also known as H.R. 1. The bill passed in July is set to cut $120 billion from SNAP nationwide over the next 10 years. DCYF estimates Minnesota will lose about half of the federal reimbursements it's been getting.
We know that the state cannot make up for all of the federal funding that has been coming into our state. I don't think any state can across the nation.
Commissioner Brown says she's trying to figure out how to address this impending nearly $40 million shortfall.
Do we need to modify or adjust ways that we have traditionally done the program in order to manage some of these cost shifts that are coming? I think the counties have been really clear about how they are having to raise their property taxes to help manage some of the anticipated administrative cuts.
On the ground, hunger relief organizations like Second Harvest Heartland are trying to help the thousands of Minnesotans who could lose access to SNAP benefits due to expanded minimum work requirements that went into effect in November. That change has led to more people needing to prove they are working a certain number of hours in order to receive benefits.
I think we had a call recently from somebody who was 64, and they got a letter in the mail saying they're going to have to go back to work.
That's Mesa Siebert with Second Harvest.
And they were really scared. They were wondering how that was going to happen. They live in a rural area. There's not a lot of jobs. They're on disability.
Siebert says there are also changes to eligibility that have occurred due to H.R. 1.
Folks who are here legally, maybe on a refugee visa or an asylee visa, a trafficking humanitarian visa, will be impacted by the H.R. 1 bill.
Commissioner Brown anticipates all these cuts and changes will stress an already stressed system.
There are long-term impacts that impact everybody across the state as a result of these federal cost shifts. And we already see over 9 million visits per year with our food shelves, and that need is increasing. And so we have a real issue, I think, with ensuring that people get the food they need with more and more limited resources and more constraints. And that's a pretty significant concern.
This is Nak Bui for North Star Stories.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Hennepin County Medical Center is expanding religious accommodations in its inpatient psychiatry department. Hennepin Healthcare, located in Minneapolis, has added more than 70 Qibla stickers, markers that show the direction Muslims face when performing their daily prayers, which is toward the Kaaba in Mecca. The effort began after a doctor in the emergency department noticed a patient praying in the wrong direction and researched how hotels use similar markers.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
Today, a $4 billion rural data center is proposed in southwest Minnesota. Then, an emergency landing has some asking about tribal sovereignty. And Minnesota rolls out a new DWI sticker system. I'm Gracie J. Geronimo Power, a company with headquarters south of Minneapolis, is pitching a massive new data center project in the southwest part of the state. Geronimo and Nobles Cooperative Electric claim they aim to be transparent and environmentally responsible, arguing that the project could deliver a once-in-a-generation economic boost. Opponents of the project object to turning more farmland into energy installations. The company still needs a tech giant to commit to purchasing the campus and its renewable power. In today's main story, a small plane's emergency landing in Red Lake is raising questions about the sovereignty of airspace over tribal land. Producer Chaz Wagner talks with the pilot and representatives from Red Lake about the controversy.
Yeah, I was flying directly from Roseau to Bemidji. It was a beautiful Wednesday morning.
Earlier this fall, pilot Darren Smedsmo was flying 4,000 feet above Lower Red Lake when he experienced catastrophic engine failure. Darren quickly prepared his 1945 Stinson for an emergency landing on the closest road near the western boundary of the reservation.
A neighbor of mine, absolute coincidence, was right behind me, saw the whole thing. He works for the Department of Transportation. He had radio, he had strobes, he had a slow stop sign. So he stopped traffic and called the tribal police.
The Red Lake Tribal Police were the first to arrive on scene, quickly seizing the plane, citing a 1978 resolution prohibiting the flying of airplanes at a low altitude, less than 20,000 feet over Red Lake tribal lands. Darren says he was unaware of any airline jurisdictions over reservation territories.
Nobody's heard anything about it. The flight school that I was on my way to had heard nothing about it, and they train over that land. So I had filed a flight plan that day. It was actually the first flight plan I had filed in over 30 years.
The Red Lake Tribal Government released a series of statements following the incident stating the plane had not been authorized to land on the reservation and the landing created immediate safety, liability, and resource protection concerns for the tribe.
Red Lake is a little bit separate from the other tribes, where Red Lake did not join the Minnesota Chippewa tribe, and we stand a little more alone.
That's Rebecca Tweeden, a U.S. Army veteran and member of the Red Lake Band of Ojibwe.
Red Lake maintained its own hunting and fishing rights, and it is a little bit separate from the other tribes because the other Chippewa or Ojibwe tribes, they joined the Minnesota Chippewa tribe and have kind of like a unity where they can challenge anything that comes up to them.
Six of the seven Minnesota reservations were allotted at the time of the passage of the 1887 General Allotment Act. Red Lake Reservation was never allotted, and the land continues to be held in common by all tribal members. The Treaty of Old Crossing in 1863 officially recognized Red Lake as a separate and distinct tribe. Smedsmo says he's grateful for how Red Lake tribal authorities treated him.
The police department director was wonderful to me. The tow truck lady, she hugged me and she hugged my wife. And the prosecutor, he was very respectful.
A trial hearing was scheduled for November 3rd, but was postponed. A new date is yet to be announced. Red Lake Nation Legal Department did not respond to North Star Stories' request for comment. For North Star Stories, I'm Chaz Wagner.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Minnesota is replacing special license plates with permanent stickers to identify vehicles stopped for driving while impaired, or DWI. Officers will now place the invalidation sticker directly over the license plate, which will also be canceled in the state databases. Police say the new system is faster and safer, and consequences for drivers remain the same. Lawmakers say the changes reduce risks for officers and eliminate the need to store and destroy thousands of seized plates.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
In today's segment, a historical moment in Minnesota sports broadcasting, then what the city of Minneapolis is doing to improve policing, and why you may need to do some gardening yet this winter. I'm Chantel Sings. The Minnesota Wild made history with the first ever Ojibwe language broadcast of a National Hockey League game. The special stream aired on Native American Heritage Day when the Wild hosted the Colorado Avalanche. Grand Casino, the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe, and the Midwest Indigenous Immersion Network partnered to produce the broadcast. Organizers say the project strengthens cultural identity and normalizes the Ojibwe language in public places. Next, the City of Minneapolis and its police department have worked together to address race-based policing and improve public safety. Producer Catherine DeSalle has more about what has changed since the murder of George Floyd.
No justice!
No peace! Prosecute the police!
After the murder of George Floyd from a Minneapolis police officer, the Minnesota Department of Human Rights discovered that the Minneapolis Police Department had a decade-long pattern of racial discrimination and unconstitutional policing. This led to a court-enforced agreement called a consent decree, whose goal is to reform the Minneapolis Police Department.
They are working hard every day, and there is a system that still has to be built.
That's our Linda Westbrook with Effective Law Enforcement for All, an independent monitoring team that's overseeing the Minneapolis consent decree. She's speaking at the Reimagining Justice Conference in Minneapolis about the Minneapolis Police Department and the systems that still need to be put in place to end race-based policing.
Systems are going to take a while. I don't want the system to hinder our ability up here to continue to build transparency and make sure that the community feels valued and engaged.
Also speaking at the conference is Ganesha Martin. She is the chief of the Minneapolis Police Department's Constitutional Policing Bureau, and she says that in order for the department to have transparency, they need to have the tools and technology to record and measure that transparency, which requires more funding to hire more officers and to purchase the new technology.
How you actually come up with a metric to identify if a stop is race-based or not. There's not technology where you can automatically put it in as analytics. Right now, I'm in the process of trying to hire the right people that can do that type of stuff in the police department.
Ganesha says that after 2020, over 400 Minneapolis police officers either retired or left the force. With less officers on the force, Ganesha says it's hard to make the internal changes that need to happen to see a real change in policing.
Sometimes it is hard to acknowledge that police are human, and these are the humans that we are expecting to go into our communities. Whether you hate the police, love the police, they are part of this process.
The Minneapolis consent decree requires public input on any policy changes. But currently, Ganesha says there's just one person in the police department that handles all policy writing and public comments.
We actually do need a system because there is one guy who is writing policy, who is reviewing it, is doing the best practices, and he was taking in all those lovely comments, trying to translate them.
The conference left attendees asking if the Minneapolis consent decree is working, something that the panelists say only time will tell. For North Star Stories, I'm Catherine DeSalle.
You are listening to North Star Stories. Your gardening to-do list may not be done for the year. According to the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, or DNR, now is the ideal time to prune or cut oaks without the risk of oak wilt infection. Oak wilt is an invasive fungal disease deadly to all of Minnesota's oak species. It spreads by sap-feeding beetles active in warm weather. The disease is common in east central and southeast Minnesota and is expanding north and west. More details about oak wilt can be found on the DNR's website.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the state of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
Welcome to Minnesota Native News. I'm Marie Rock.
This week, how the newly established Minnesota Sustainable Foraging Task Force is making decisions about statewide foraging rules, plus a conversation with Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe representatives about the newly named Grand Casino Arena in St. Paul. First, as officials rethink how people harvest from public lands, Indigenous advocates are reminding the state that for many communities, foraging is an inherited responsibility as much as a right. Zan Holston has more.
I grew up picking wildflowers. My daughters currently pick wildflowers.
Nibio Gichidaikwe, whose name means water warrior woman, said gathering plants has always been a part of her life. Now, she's helping the state rethink how foraging fits into Minnesota's public lands. She is the Ojibwe representative for the Minnesota Indian Affairs Council, one of the groups guiding the legislative task force on state foraging rules.
I guess we've been breaking the law without even knowing about it because we're not supposed to be picking the flowers out there.
Minnesota's Department of Natural Resources has different and sometimes unclear regulations, including an outdated permitting system for foraging in parks, forest, and wildlife management areas. But for Indigenous foragers, Nibio Gichidaikwe says those rules don't align with long-held relationships with the land, and the decisions about foraging shouldn't be framed around restriction, but care.
State land means that it's owned by the people. We should be allowed to use our land in a way that is helpful and healthy and good for all of us.
She said policies designed to prevent exploitation have ended up preventing families from gathering real food and medicine on the land their ancestors took care of.
There are too many restrictions on having that close connection to our plants.
The task force is weighing how to protect ecosystems while making space for sustainable, culturally rooted harvesting. That includes deciding whether the state will continue requiring permits for harvesting plants, which plants should be off limits, and how to teach responsible gathering. She hopes any new rules will reflect the idea that foraging is both a cultural practice and a form of caretaking, and not a threat to the landscape.
Foraging for foods and medicines is our traditional way of life.
The Foraging Task Force is accepting public comment, and more information is available at lcc.mn.gov/foraging. It will release its recommendations to the state legislature in February. For Minnesota Native News, I'm Zan Holston.
Next, as of September 3rd, the XL Energy Center has been renamed the Grand Casino Arena. Reporter Travis Zimmerman talked with representatives from Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe about how they plan to use the venue to tell their story.
The Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe has partnered with Minnesota Sports and Entertainment to secure the naming rights of the former XL Energy Center. It is now Grand Casino Arena and will be for at least the next 14 years. Virgil Wynn, chief executive of the Mille Lacs Band, hopes to use the space to educate visitors about Ojibwe history and culture.
This partnership is not just a name on a building. It's really about pride. It's about progress. It's about lifting up our stories, honoring our heritage, and making a space for the next generation. We want everyone that walks in the Grand Casino Arena to feel the heart of the Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe.
Sina Matrius, director of partner relations for Grand Casino, has been busy making sure that message is front and center for visitors to the arena.
A message that reads, "The Mille Lacs Band of Ojibwe welcomes you."
Chairman Wynn shares his vision of what he would like to see.
Cultural art, Ojibwe language elements, and interpretive displays and exhibits that reflect our history, our homeland, who we are.
This partnership also provides a unique opportunity to work more closely with the Minnesota Wild and the National Hockey League, which was on display recently when the Wild hosted November's Native American Heritage Night. The event included a video about the jingle dress, as well as something that has never been heard before.
Broadcasting the game in Ojibwe language, a historic first in the NHL.
Wind is optimistic that this venture will increase visibility of the Mille Lacs Band, as well as be a catalyst for future partnerships.
These partnerships help build relationships, celebrate our identity.
For Minnesota Native News, this is Travis Zimmerman.
Minnesota Native News is produced by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, made possible by funding from the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund and the citizens of Minnesota.
Support for KFAI comes from The Dakota, presenting The Bad Plus, performing Thursday, December 25th through Saturday, December 27th.
For 25 years, Minnesota Jazz Quartet, The Bad Plus, have defied convention in the best possible way, combining jazz with rock, fusion, and even new age sounds. They're touring with their latest release, Complex Emotions. The Bad Plus have evolved over the years, yet their model of musical democracy continues to be the heart of the group. More information about The Bad Plus is available at DakotaCooks.com.